ComingToBook.com.
Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Monday, December 4th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour and a half or so. We're going over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me to kick off another week here. Tons and tons of stuff coming your way on today's show. We'll be joined first by Joe Everett from NFL Draft Bible for our NFL Week in Review and Monday Night Football preview. The Steelers take on the Bengals here tonight. Some interesting injury updates here going on this morning, so we'll talk about that. Then also take a look back at Week 13. We'll talk a little bit of Jimmy Garoppolo, the Los Angeles Chargers being on a move, the Dallas Cowboys bouncing back a little bit, New York Jets, who, of course, passed their season win total. We talked about that last Friday with Brent from DSI Sportsbook. But the Jets pick up that all-important fifth win. A lot of money on that Jets under for the season win total. That all goes up in flames there with that win over Kansas City. So plenty of things to talk about on the NFL side. On the college football side, we'll talk with Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com later on in today's show. We'll talk about the Army-Navy game, which is one of our favorite times of the year, the bowl matchups, some bowl betting tips, things of that sort, and then also a lot of college basketball stuff on today's show. Some injury updates and trends, a buy low and sell high on some teams, a breakdown of the Big Ten, and then we'll look at a couple of games here for this week. So tons of stuff coming your way here on today's edition, of Bang the Book Radio. Before we get into that, a few things I want to bring to your attention here. I wrote a couple of updated futures pieces for college basketball and Major League Baseball over at bangthebook.com. We're going to try to update those on a monthly basis here. And of course, after next week's winter meetings for Major League Baseball, I'll write either a separate article or update that futures one, looking at some of the ramifications of the transactions that take place there during the winter meetings. Lots of talk. I know we're all NFL, all basketball right now, but Major League Baseball, my favorite sport, so whenever I get a chance to touch on that, I'm going to. But my NBA and NHL situational betting articles are up over at bangthebook.com as well. I've got my college football playoff semifinal previews written up. I'll post those here this afternoon, along with my college football power ratings piece, NFL and college football opening line reports, just tons of stuff going on over there at bangthebook.com. We are your one-stop shop for sports betting news information. Go ahead and bring on today's first guest. That is Mr. Joe Everett from NFL Draft Bible. Joseph, how are you today, man?
I'm doing great. Starting to figure out some of these teams, but I can't believe we're staring at the last 4 weeks of the regular season already.
Yeah, we are. And let's go ahead and start with that here for a second before we look at tonight's Monday Night Football game between the Steelers and Bengals. 4 weeks left. So you have teams that are going to have very, very different motivations here at this time of the year. Obviously, you've got a lot of teams in the playoff hunt in the AFC because, for a while, we didn't even have, I think we had, four teams or five teams that were over 500. Well, right now, we've got five of them. And then a big 6-6 cluster, over in the AFC West. So we still have some teams that are fighting for playoff spots. We also have teams that are fighting for draft positioning. We all know who those are. But, Joe, I mean, is the notion of tanking in the NFL overblown? I mean, are there really that many teams that are going to mail it in?
Well, I think you just have your handful just every year. That's never going to go out of style, especially when, if you're not looking ahead, you're really cheating yourself, especially in a class like this. There's been a lot of criticisms of that quarterback position, but, boy, there's a lot of guys. So I'm not going to fault any team if they're putting it out there. But, no, it's at this juncture of the season, there still is, like you mentioned, a whole Dexter McCluster of teams just really vying for that in the AFC. And then there's still a lot of teams in the NFC, one of which is we're going to get to. But, yeah, Green Bay, Detroit, Atlanta, those are just still – quality rosters that, someone's going to have to be on the outside looking in, but at this point, they're still going gung-ho. I mean, they're going hard for this, and it's a tough point in the season sometimes, I think, to gauge motivation because, you just have that little handful of teams that it's like, well, I'm not counting on anything at this. They're a do-not-touch blacklist kind of team, but the rest of them, take your pick.
I'm not sure if you can answer this, but I'll throw the question out there and we'll see what you have to say about it. All these teams have played 12 games now to this point, except of course for Pittsburgh and Cincinnati who play tonight. So you got four games left to go. And this is a grueling, violent sport. Everybody's hurt. by this point in the season. It's all a matter of pain management and how much Toradol you can take without falling over and just being in a comatose state. So does the later part of the season favor certain types of teams? I mean, with teams that are more pass happy, is it something that's better for them because, you know, guys are wearing down a little bit more in the trenches? Does it help run heavy teams because you can wear down opposing defenses? What sort of approach would you take in that regard?
Strong defensive teams with solid rosters, deep rosters. The super contest team. If Mike Zimmer has a healthy defense and those corners and all those DBs are healthy, that's just, I don't care what's going on in the offense, they may win a 3-6 slugfest. Then no one will be surprised about it either because it's the Vikings. You know, I hate to go back just to last night, but the Sea Hags and what they were able to pull out, it's because that still, you know, and I'll take it one on the chin there. I had an Eagles ticket, and, you know, I'm not alone. But that defense, the attitude they have, that kind of still sinks in. They're not a depleted roster. And then, geez, what can you say about that quarterback? So I'm trying to find a team on the AFC side that's similar to that, where the entirety of the roster is just kind of bled over and said, no, we're just still too good of a team core. And really, I guess I'd have to keep it on the NFC and go Eagles. Yeah, they just lost, but that's a deep roster. That's a whole squad that's been put together. They've got some strong backups, not just starters. So, yeah, I would look for teams with great depth at this position, especially when you bring up those injuries. And, yeah, the team that stands out is the team on top in the NFC, and that's, I think, the reason why. They've had the hard luck injuries, but the Vikings still standing and still just looking strong.
All right, well, let's take a look here at this Monday Night Football game. You got the Pittsburgh Steelers on the road taking on the Cincinnati Bengals down at Paul Brown Stadium. And this is an interesting line. It opened 5.5, kind of set in that dead zone throughout the week. It's mostly still in that dead zone, sitting at 4.5. A couple of the sharper offshores, the Greek and the Pinnacle, Greek and Pinnacle, I should say, have gone down to 4. DSI still 4.5. BetOnline showing some indication of dropping down to 4 there because they've got 4.5 minus 15 on the dog. What's really interesting is that the report out there today circulating around Twitter, and this is something that Adam Schefter has already talked about here this morning, Antonio Brown is questionable with a toe injury, and this would be a significant blow for the Pittsburgh Steelers here. And, you know, I think Antonio Brown's going to go, but it's very clear that he's a guy that's not 100%. And one of the things I've noticed with the Steelers here this season, and I wrote about this in the game preview, which is over on the homepage at bangthebook.com, is that Ben Roethlisberger is just not the same dude. Antonio Brown's just bailing him out. Juju Smith-Schuster has been a nice addition with the downfield threat. You know what Le'Veon Bell can do in the passing game. But I kind of wonder, you know, how sustainable this whole thing is for Pittsburgh. The defense has been great. The offense is really pedestrian despite huge numbers from two guys.
It's the worry, and I'm not going to argue you one bit. Brown, AB has been bailing Ben out, and it's not just this year. I think it's been going on for last season. It's probably the big reason why Ben's, you know, still in the league and, you know, not, I guess he talked about retirement. I don't know what kind of serious context that was, but it's because he's playing with such a special receiver. And the worry here is it's another downgrade. Of course, last week I was talking about Terrell Suggs getting downgraded in the practice report, and he had, well, I don't know, the game of the season for him. So say what you want about that. But he practiced Thursday and then Friday and Saturday missed. So you just hate to see a guy within practice getting hurt and then missing the last two. He did travel with the team, so that's why there's a chance. But I've got to believe just Brown, knowing him, this guy's such a me-first self-promoter. I find it hard to believe he won't tough it out and get on the field. I mean, he'll definitely be at a less than 100%, but this is a classic diva, me loving me some me. So primetime television, yeah, I'd have a tough time believing AB is in street clothes for this one. But I think either way, one thing I'm kind of looking at this matchup, Juju Smith-Schuster you brought up, I would think a yardage prop on the over for him might be a good look. Probably going to be hiked up on that, but they've got to go somewhere. And playing the Bengals, they've got some talent at linebackers, so I don't know what Jesse James is going to be able to do, but you got to think Smith-Schuster's going to have to be heavily leaned on, as well as Le'Veon Bell versus Vontaze Burfict. That's your premium match on that side of the ball. But I would look to him. And then, on the other side, we talked on the Super Contest. I'm still not convinced Andy Dalton isn't colorblind. The Bengals still have problem on the O-line, particularly at tackle. And, if they get stuck with a point deficit and, Brown does play and that recipe starts to, come to fruition, I really have those doubts if Dalton's seeing the field. Recognizing the blitz has been a problem. And, if the Bengals get in trouble, I will guarantee one thing in this game. You'll see Dalton throwing the ball away a minimum of 10 times. And the prop bet I'd like to find is Andy Dalton throwing the ball away on fourth down at some point. It seems every time I watch him on fourth and down or just coming back with a deficit, this turnover on downs, why Andy Dalton threw it out of bounds. It's just I'm fully expecting that at some point in this game if it goes right. But, if A.B. doesn't play, since he gets Joe Mixon working and he has kind of a breakout game there, it certainly could go the Bengals' way at some point. If you're watching anybody besides Le'Veon Bell, the other side, obviously A.J. Green, Artie Burns, I think that's a really good matchup. Artie Burns is a pretty underrated corner, and that's a guy that could run with A.J. and give him some problems too. So that's what I'm looking for in the game. But, if I'm tempted and anything sticks out like a sore thumb at him, I think Juju Smith-Schuster has to step up. They really need him, and I think he's just a good player. That Steelers, that not only do they develop the talent, but they go out and find players, and this is another example of them just, they get it right at wide receiver so often. I've probably bored listeners, but, it dates back. Emmanuel Sanders, Mike Wallace, obviously what they've done with Antonio Brown, and they've done it again with Smith-Schuster. So I think, he's in store for a lot of action, a lot of targets. Maybe even a look at his prop on receptions wouldn't be a bad idea either.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about this game, what's really interesting about the NFL overall is that the teams that play really good defense, even if they don't have good offenses, they generally tend to be in a lot of games. Now, of course, the Browns were doing okay from a yards per play standpoint. That's because they were stuffing the run. They've actually been pretty bad against the pass here throughout the season, and we saw that yesterday against San Diego on a game that we'll talk about here in a few minutes. But the teams that are really good defensively are the teams that are having a lot of success. Pittsburgh, a lot of success. In my opinion, Cincinnati being 5-6 and being on the fringes here of the playoff race, that's really successful for them given how poor their offense has been. Just 4.9 yards per play this season. Dalton has an 18-8 ratio and a 62% completion percentage, which are fine, but he's averaging less than 200 yards per game because there's just no explosive play threat at all whatsoever for the Cincinnati team. And that's what you look at with the good offenses here in this league. Pittsburgh's offense, 5.6 yards per play. It's getting better here of late, but Antonio Brown has 20 plays of 20 or more yards. That's your elixir. That's your safety net. That's your cure-all. To have a guy like that that can catch anything that he can reach and can have some big plays out of it as well, that completely changes the dynamic of an offense. So for Pittsburgh here, great defense, one great player in Antonio Brown, one very, very good player in Le'Veon Bell, and that's kind of the framework to be a 9-2 team here like Pittsburgh is. Now, the thing that I'm looking at in this game is that, and the reason that I took Cincinnati in the Super Contest at +5 with my last play last week, is that I think this is a defensive slugfest. I've already talked about it. I think Ben Roethlisberger is regressing. And Brad coverage on Antonio Brown really hasn't stopped him yet to this point. But Cincinnati is a defense that knows him very well. Paul Gunther is doing a very good job. I think he's going to be a very attractive defensive coordinator somewhere if Marvin Lewis is fired. And who knows? Maybe Gunther becomes the head coach here in Cincinnati. I really don't know. But I think defensively, Cincinnati can figure this thing out. They've only allowed 33.6% conversion rate on third down. So I think this is a low-scoring game, so that's why I would take the points. But I will say this Pittsburgh offense has gradually gotten better here lately. And maybe it's level of competition that they've played, playing teams like Tennessee that can't stop the pass, playing teams like Green Bay that have a lot of issues. But What about the long-term prospects of this Steelers team, Joe? I mean, the defense, we've spoken about it already. The offense, we've spoken about it already. Can this team go out there and beat a New England? Can this team go out there and, you know, avoid a landmine against one of those inconsistent wild card types of teams?
Well, we're going to find out in 3 weeks, New England. But, this should certainly going to need AB, and that's what's really going to be. It could be really poor performance tonight if he's not out there, because just what you said, the elixir, the team deodorant, that's what he is. So hopefully that's not serious. But, yeah, if they have him, that they're definitely going to be competitive. I mean, there's not a question on my mind. They're still they can score with anybody, and I think that's where the Steelers do have a little fortune on their side, that I think the defense is finally caught up. The one guy they can't lose would be Ryan Shazier. If he's healthy, that's the coverage man. That's the guy who's calling the defense. He's flying around. That's a good part of their defense. And then Cameron Hayward, I think, is also having a Pro Bowl season. So, yeah, that side of the ball, I think, isn't as big an issue as it has been in the past. So I still look for this team. Yeah, and plus, this is the speaks, I think, to the lack of talent in the AFC. Not talent, but just quality teams. You know, they're going to be in that playoff mix, and they're going to play they're probably going to play a bad team at the start of the playoffs, and that's why the Bengals are not completely knocked out of contention. It's just there's just a lot of middle and white noise, and there's a few like real quality teams, and that's Pittsburgh and New England are just still, unfortunately, the only ones on that side in that conference that you can put in part of that conversation.
All right, let's take a look back here at the games that have happened during Week 13, and let's start with the San Francisco 49ers. And there is nothing more Chicago Bears than losing 15-14 on 5 Robbie Gould field goals. That is the penultimate Chicago Bears moment here. John Fox is going to be fired here. There's really no question about that. The Bears only had 36 offensive plays in this game, 147 total yards. San Francisco ran 73 plays, 5.3 yards per play, 388 yards overall. Obviously, the big story here is the debut of Jimmy Garoppolo as the starter for the 49ers. Had that mop-up work a little bit last week. Comes in 26 of 37 for 293. Didn't throw a touchdown, threw one interception. Kind of a new-look 49ers team here. They go on the road to Chicago, win the game. Garoppolo looks pretty good. Hey, I mean, what do you do with this team here going forward then?
Oh, I'm buying stock. But I think Garoppolo didn't just look good. He was legit. And the best part about this right now is his stat line doesn't really tell you, oh, wow, that's not impressive. There's no touchdowns, you know, and they had some turnovers. It's just like you mentioned, credit. This was the Robbie Gould Bowl. Who knew? Good on him that he got to stick it to his former team, but yeah, that's the story. Just I've watched it now twice, and I'm sure on the NFL YouTube account, they'll probably put all the cut-ups of Garoppolo's throws and snaps. I would encourage everyone to watch it. He stood tall in the pocket. He's got the hitch. He's got the drop. Nice feet. And it's just a real developed in, you know, regard to the footwork being married to the throw-in motion. That's part of the whole process that you have to teach some of these guys in pro sets, and it's already there, the maneuver, position, align, and fire. And Jimmy G spins the ball. I mean, it's a thing of beauty to watch this kid throw. I got up out of my seat a couple of times in the first game with a Ric Flair after a couple of these throws. I mean, just woof. He zips it, man. And there was not a lot downfield. There's not like any plus 30, plus 40 type of shots. So we didn't get to see the gun. There's no howitzer debut just yet. But what you saw is effortlessly darting that ball around. I think he's the real deal. I think he sprayed the field with that daggone ball. And, man, just how he drove that team was what you really like to see, the chunk gains. I'm buying stock in Jimmy Garoppolo. I'm not going out and buying a jersey. Now I won't don any 49ers jersey ever. But I do believe in the teaching and the ability to develop players also with Kyle Shanahan. We lean on coaching on this show, and I'll tell you what, look out for him next year, but also they're going to be competitive the rest of this way. Everyone interviewed after San Francisco, the fans are jacked up. People are getting pictures with them. New England's locker room is celebrating this kid's victory. That shows you what he meant to that locker room, the what they respect as a player he is. And, yeah, man, I cannot stress enough. A star is born. And yeah, I may sound full of it. He may look like crap next week. I don't care. I'm still buying up stock. I'm scooping it up, eating it up. And, I ride with Jimmy G and the 49ers going forward. I can't wait until next season, but also this season. I would encourage listeners to kind of look for those value spots in the 49ers because they're going to be very consistent. This kid looks like a franchise passer, and boy, did they get it right. Passing on Trubisky, making that trade, deciding no-go on this draft class of QBs, and we'll go from there. And I think they've really found themselves a terrific alternative and not just an just a long-term answer. Good on John Lynch, Shanny, and the whole 49ers. I think they're going up.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Kyle Shanahan and how much we love him here on this show. And what I really love about looking at the box score for this game, Marquise Goodwin, 8 targets, 8 catches. Trent Taylor, 6 targets, 6 catches. Goodwin is a guy that had 27 receptions out of 62 targets with C.J. Beathard and Brian Hoyer throwing to him. Taylor was a little bit better, 26 of 40. But you know, this is so important. The ability in today's NFL to throw open a receiver is probably the most important weapon a quarterback has. And Garoppolo has that, and Kyle Shanahan's going to get his dudes open. We've talked about his play design. We talked about what he was able to do with Matt Ryan and a talented cast of wide receivers there in Atlanta. If he can do that with this pedestrian group for San Francisco, much like he did when he was in Cleveland for a year, this is a San Francisco offense that, you know, isn't just going to improve, but it's probably going to be an average type of group here, not just the rest of the way, but then, of course, heading on into next season as well. To go 14 of 14 on targets to your two primary pass catchers, that's something that gets me really excited about Garoppolo. It's how the 49ers are going to move the football. It's going to help them open up the running game. They didn't run the ball all that effectively in this game, but Chicago's got a pretty good run defense. Vic Fangio does a good job stopping the run. So I'm going to give them a pass here for this week. But you know, next week, taking on a Houston team that has some defensive concerns. 2 weeks, taking on a Tennessee team that can't stop anybody's passing attack. Then a pretty good stiff test against Jacksonville and the Rams to wrap up the year. I'd be looking to buy the 49ers this week against Houston on the road. Definitely in that game against Tennessee at home, especially because Tennessee will probably be a little bit inflated given what's going on in the AFC South standings. But that was the big thing that stood out to me, was Garoppolo throwing the ball to his two primary targets, doing so efficiently, doing so effectively. That changes the entire complexion of a game. I mean, Goodwin's a guy with over 19 yards per catch this year. If you can get him the football, He can make things happen. And Garoppolo got him the football and should continue to going forward.
The efficiency you highlighted, I think, needs to be mentioned there. And just finding so many targets, creating those throwing lanes, and, yeah, the matchups he's got. Tennessee's secondary is just horrible. So you got to think they're going to score the points, maybe a yardage prop here and there, but it's infectious. The whole locker room now is jacked up, and they know it. They know it's like, well, finally, we've got the difference maker here. I just need to make that difference, need to make that extra play, and I think you'll find going forward it will be made. And a lot of those extra players may be playing a little bit above their heads because they know who they've got running the show on that side of the ball.
All right, let's talk about the Los Angeles Chargers. And they were a team I isolated a couple of weeks ago before their game against the Cowboys as being a team that I thought, you know, was maybe ready to go on one of those moves and put themselves into playoff contention. They needed a few things to fall their way. Well, they have, because Kansas City, complete free fall here. The Chiefs have just, they're dropping like a rock, and I don't know when they're actually going to hit the ground. Maybe a loss to the Jets with Marcus Peters launching a flag into the crowd is maybe that bottom for them. But all of a sudden, you've got this Chargers team here. Now, I know they beat the Browns, and beating the Browns means nothing. They didn't even cover against the Browns, so shame on them for that. But the last 3 weeks here for the Chargers, 429 yards against the Bills, 515 against Dallas, 429 against Cleveland. Kenny Wisenhunt's got this thing going in the right direction with Phillip Rivers slinging it out there.
That and Keenan Allen is having a whale of a season. The guy – I forget if it was an Achilles or an ACL, PCL thing last year. He missed most of the year, and now making his case for comeback player of the year. If he doesn't win it, I'm just going to rip some hair out, because a huge fan of his game, and why he slipped in the draft is still beyond me. And they still have a lot of star power there. Melvin Gordon's no stiff. I think he's a real threat to any defense. So yeah, it's that they control their destiny is the team I'm looking at. And you mentioned it, the Chiefs just gave them a gift wrap present on Christmas Day there. I mean, if they're not giving them a call and rounding them up, that's just, the schedule looks good too. I mean, what is it, beat up Redskins team to go to Arrowhead and the Chiefs, and then see what about the Jets, but I don't trust the Raiders at all to close out the season. So yeah, winnable slate. Rivers is still a boss, and that it's those two ends. I always talk about players that are worth the price of admission. Melvin Ingram and Joey Bosa, like what Melvin Ingram's turned himself into, that wider stance, playing with his hand in the dirt now, the transition from linebacker, because he is kind of a hybrid, but yeah, that's just been amazing to watch. And Joey Bosa, I mean, what can you say? He's a manimal. Right? He's out of control, and the guy just, he cannot consistently be blocked one-on-one, and that's the problem going forward for other teams. They've got that recipe that really stinks if they build a lead for the other team, because they can just basically unleash those two hounds and send them off going buck wild. And it's just, the real shame here is them starting off 0-4 with those hard luck losses. Like, it's a couple losses by three, a couple losses by two. It's just, they could have just held on for a few of those. They'd actually have a stranglehold on what's been a really terrible division. So that's the real shame on them. But I think, yeah, watching them not cover, it's the Browns. Some people think, oh, geez, what, can I trust these Chargers? I still do going forward, just because, like you mentioned, that there's just so much motivation on their side. I think they really see a light at the end of that tunnel at this point, and there's an actual prize there. Who knows? I mean, the team you just didn't think had a lot going for them with that move. Phillip Rivers taking that super band to games, watching film, I guess that's paid off. But more than anything, having that veteran quarterback, having a receiver, that go-to guy that's just playing out of his mind right now, they've got a decent recipe. So that's a team I'm not afraid to back, even though I don't like them. Never been a Phillip Rivers fan, but hey, let's get some money the last 4 weeks, and let's sidle up with those Chargers.
I will say this. There is one thing that really concerns me, and I watched a decent chunk of this game yesterday, just wanted to kind of chill and relax at home, and I don't know why I decided that watching the Browns would be a good way to do that. But the Chargers here over the last 3 weeks are just 4 of 14 in the red zone. They've settled for a lot of field goals, and of course they're going through kickers with Nick Novak hurt. Travis Kuhn's hit a bunch of his chip shots, missed a 38-yarder yesterday. But 4 of 14 in the red zone, when you've got Keenan Allen, when you've got two really good tight ends in Hunter Henry and Antonio Gates, you've got a guy in Austin Eckler who seems to be a pretty good slash type of wide receiver between catching the ball and running the ball. I don't get it. I don't understand how you can be that ineffective here against the Cowboys defense. It's really not great without Sean Lee. A Browns defense you should still do a little bit better than the 1 for 4 that the Chargers did yesterday. And then the Bills, they were 2 for 5 in that game in the red zone. Now they scored 54 points, but they still had some problems there inside the 20. So that is one thing that does concern me a little bit about Los Angeles. And it's something that, I kind of wonder about, because this is a team that, we were kind of talking about it last week, and we were sort of joking about it, that they were laying 14 against Cleveland when they're a team that plays a lot of fourth quarter close games. Well, if they can't figure this red zone thing out, what does happen to them when they start playing against better competition? What happens when Washington comes to town this week? Does Kansas City have this thing figured out by December 16th? The Jets, are they still playing on December 24th? The Raiders are a terrible defense, and that could be for a playoff spot. So that's an altogether different animal. But that is a concern I have, is that the Chargers aren't punching in touchdowns in the red zone. And at some point, that has to catch up with a team like this.
Oh, yeah, it most definitely will, especially if they make it to the postseason. The same thing will happen when they played Jacksonville earlier and lost by three, another close one, and then New England, of course, got the best of them. But, yeah, I think the problem is that patchwork O-line. They really were counting on the kid from Western Kentucky who's out right now.
Forrest Lamp.
Forrest Lamp, exactly. That was supposed to be a real fail-safe on the interior. And Dan Feeney's played pretty well, but it's just shifting guys in and out there, I think, has been a real issue. But I trust in Gus Bradley, this new defense, and it just that kind of sets the tone for the rest of it. But, yeah, I definitely agree. Like, scoring in close quarters when on the short yardage, that has been an issue, and that's where I'd look up front. And, yeah, Melvin Gordon's talented. Austin Eckler's a nice story, but neither of those guys are big bangers. It seems like they could really use maybe a larger back to add to that mix. I don't know if they could do something free agency, but, it's still a team. They've got a lot of elements to this mix that I think other teams look at and say, boy, I wish they weren't on our schedule.
Oh, while we're here talking about this game, let's talk about the Browns for a minute. I know you wanted to focus on Josh Gordon, and I think it's a good place to focus here. But, you know, as I was watching this Browns game yesterday, and I even made a tweet about this, the Browns have some dudes that can ball. I mean, Josh Gordon can play. David Njoku can play. I love Duke Johnson. I think Hugh Jackson just somehow doesn't know how to use him correctly, even though this is a similar setup to what he had in Cincinnati with a bigger back in Crowell, the more skilled pass catcher, the more shifty guy in Duke Johnson. I don't know why he can't seem to get that equation figured out completely. You know, Joe Schobert's a great linebacker against the run. He's not much in pass coverage, but he's pretty good against the run. Myles Garrett's a dude. Emmanuel Ogba's a dude. You know, they have these individual pieces and parts that can play, including a guy like Josh Gordon, who we'll talk about in a second, but they just don't have anything to bring it all together. And whether that's the coach, whether that's DeShone Kizer, I don't know. But this is a team, despite being 0-12, they have some building blocks, and I'm really curious to see, you know, how they take this thing going forward, who they isolate as the quarterback that can get the ball to Gordon and Njoku, and, you know, even a guy like Corey Coleman, who there's still some untapped potential there. Curious to see what they do from a head coach standpoint. There's some dudes that can ball here, though.
Oh, no question about it. And really, I don't know that they were expecting it from Myles Garrett to be this good. Now, of course, he's missed that time with injury, but boy, as soon as he got out there, it's 100 miles per hour, hit the ground running kind of type. And Joe Schobert is a great story, especially just, I guess, you know, it was really the coordinator, Greg Williams, kind of being honest with him, like, you need to lose about 30 pounds and start running faster. I need a coverage linebacker to get out here and make the difference. And he kind of transformed his body a little bit to fit the scheme. And, you know, it's really helped out the Burgess, too, that injury to Collins. I mean, just making that acquisition, you know, they were going to really kind of rely on Collins. And, boy, they haven't missed a beat there. So there's tons of elements, I think, on this defense. What they get out of Jabril Peppers going forward, I mean, I honestly thought he wasn't much of a safety prospect compared to some of the other players in this class, kind of like Marcus Williams, Utah, a little bit better. But just Peppers' athletic ability eventually is going to be transformed into something real. I mean, he's already a dynamic kick returner, but just as a strong safety prospect, he's still got a little ways to go, but he's flashed some ability. And, yeah, and Njoku. Well, even in our draft show, it's like, holy cow, you know, this. What do you do with this kind of animal that you have on that side? Because he's just oozing with athletic potential. It's just, yeah, a matter of getting him the ball, putting these people in the right places. Is Hugh the guy going forward next year? Who knows? But this is definitely an interesting team to watch because of Al Saunders, what he's able to do. Josh Gordon, I'm just hitting it, man. I'm so happy. I can't just welcome back not only, but for one brief season, what he was, it was amazing to watch. And hey, maybe the kid never gets back exactly what he had, but the glimpses are there. And boy, I really hope it happens for him, Adam, because that would be kind of a true renaissance. He may, you know, I don't think he could do it in 4 weeks, still comeback player of the year, but boy, his story is compelling and kind of what, yeah, sure. he put himself through a lot of these tough times. There's no question about that. But what I saw last week, it's not flash. It's more flash light, if you will. But there's no doubt that's a player. You look for guys like that with just something to prove. There's a gargantuan chip on his shoulder at this point, and it's, like I said, his own doing. But, man, are the Browns tempting going forward? I just look at that guy. Players we brought up that should affect the line, this is one. If he gets whole again to where he was, and what is he, 26 years old? That guy just eats cornerbacks alive. Were they playing Green Bay next week against those corners? Give me Josh Gordon to break loose on a few big plays.
Oh, and the big thing, too, about having a guy like Josh Gordon, you look at the Njoku touchdown catch on the skinny post, it was because the safety was shading toward Josh Gordon's side of the field. So you had single coverage on Njoku, who, you know, I mean, yeah, he's listed as a tight end, but he's almost more like a wide receiver because he's got those quicks, that big body that he can use. And it was an easy pitch and catch for DeShone Kizer solely because Josh Gordon was out there. That's a play that's not there if Josh Gordon's not on the field, because the safety's playing center field as opposed to being pulled around towards right field. And you had that mismatch, and kudos to Kizer for recognizing it quickly. He got the ball out very, very fast. Kudos to Hugh Jackson for the play call. But you don't get that consistency with this team. It feels like they don't know how to maximize that star power that they do have, and hopefully whoever the next coach is able to do something with that. All right, let's talk about the Dallas Cowboys here. You know, it's been all doom and gloom for the Cowboys with the Ezekiel Elliott suspension, the offensive line injuries, the Sean Lee injury. Well, then they go out there and put a thumping on somebody last week. It is the Washington Redskins. And you kind of sit back and look at this team and say, okay, you know, have they weathered the storm? Are they able to get through, you know, all the problems that they've had? Then you go and look at the box score, and they scored 38 points on 4.2 yards per play, Washington -4 in turnover margin. I'll be curious to see, you know, how Dallas is evaluated going forward. I think we kind of see it here a little bit with them laying a big number on the road against the Giants this week.
I think a lot of people are turning around. I certainly am. And yes, I know that's pretty ironic because, I don't know, it was a couple of shows ago, I was one of the people dancing on their graves, kind of saying, hey, it's time to fade the Cowboys. Sean Lee's out. Well, now it's time to pull that U-turn, I think. Sean Lee being back, but that's the news I've got for the next game. That's huge for the defense. As we've covered it before, he's not just a great back. He's that coach on the field. He's wearing the green dot for the reason. He lines them up. He audibles them out. And when that last 15 seconds of the play clock, when the mics are shut down, he's the guy you really need. You're dependent on him to make those alterations last minute to save what could be a big play. So, their offensive line has the big three back, Tyron Smith, Martin, Frederick. I still think Cooper's a liability at left guard, and I'm not a fan of roller skates out at right tackle. At least that's what I call Lyle Collins. If you watched last year against the Bears, you know what I'm talking about. But still, they're going to find ways to score with Dez Bryant. Witten's still out there. The secondary is its own problem, but the postseason's still within reach. They get the Giants, the Oakland. That's two teams they got a strong chance to beat. And then after that, they get Zeke back from suspension. So, I know they took a little bit of a shiner in that lot. You wonder if Philadelphia kind of doesn't mind losing to the Seahawks and dropping that, because it makes Seattle's case a little stronger. And Dallas, boy, they need Seattle. They need a little bit of help. So that's the one problem. But you're looking at a team that's definitely going to play hard going forward. And, I'll still stand by that. This is not last year's Dallas Cowboys. They're nothing close to last year, I think. But there's a whole lot of motivation going forward. As long as Dak, Dez, those three linemen and Sean Lee are playing, I'll definitely take my chances with the Cowboys. And you add Zeke to that mix, I'll back them. I'd be happy to do it.
One more team to touch on here for our Week in Review segment and wrap things up is the New York Jets. As I mentioned at the top of the show, they got past their season win total 4.5. People were hammering the under on that one. And they're a 5-7 football team here. And, you know, you sort of get the feeling that, you know, with everything that happened last year, Todd Bowles having to weather so many storms in that locker room, potentially getting close to losing his job as a result of some of those things. But that was right off of a 10-6 season. And you kind of wondered, you know, what the response would be for this team here this season. And I think it's been a very positive, very impressive response. I don't know if it's the leadership of somebody like a Josh McCown. I don't know if it's just that, you know, this team has gotten rid of some of those cancers that were holding them back a little bit. But this is a max effort team that goes out there, plays right with more talented teams, has beaten more talented teams this year. I know the Chiefs are in a tailspin. I know that they've got all sorts of problems of their own. But I think what's going to happen here with the outcome of this game is that people are going to focus more on the Chiefs and say, what's wrong with this team, as opposed to giving the Jets props for, you know, finding a team that was vulnerable and finding a way to pull out the game.
Yeah, and I'm just done doubting them, and you have to give them props at this point. I'm also one of those dummies that took a future on the under, and speaking of black eyes and taking a shiner, boy, I'm looking a little beat up today after that. And I don't like this roster. I'm not in love with the coaching staff. Outside of, I think, John Morton, that offensive coordinator, boy, he gets a ton of credit here. They're just tough to beat, and they're covering their butts off if you look at those numbers too. So, yeah, I'm putting it on the offense, and Josh McCown definitely keeping them games because they've let up some points, but he's a crafty vet, and they've got two players that are just developing and coming out. I mean, the Robbie Anderson, he's just winning one-on-ones. Austin Seferian Jenkins finally showing what we saw at Washington, that basketball body. He just wins those matchups, got them wide shoulders, and I think he's kind of like a poor man's Jordan Reed, except he can actually block a little, whereas Reed just doesn't even want to get his nose dirty. But, yeah, Robbie Anderson is just making money this season. That trade the Jets made for Jermaine Kearse, I think, has paid off in spades, too. They're playing good special teams, and, yeah, I don't like this team at all. Again, I'll stress, I'm not a fan of the makeup of this roster, but – I'm not going to fade them. I'm not going to step in front of them. I've learned my lesson, and I think there's a reason this look ahead here, the Broncos game, the lines moved quite a bit because, boy, two franchises moving in opposite directions here. I think the Jets have got a little something going, and Denver's got anything but.
I do think Kansas City is a team I want to play on this week. This number down from 4.5 to 3.5 as they take on the Oakland Raiders. But Kansas City in this game, 474 yards on just 46 plays. They had 10.3 yards per play in this game and found a way to lose. And the way that they lost is that the Jets had the ball for 42 minutes and 49 seconds in this game, ran 39 more offensive plays than the Chiefs. They had 85 total plays in this game. So this Chiefs defense did wear down a little bit, but the offense got back on track a little bit. And I know 70 of those yards on an Alex Smith scramble, which is something you really can't account for each week, but you know, the Chiefs look to me like a team that, you know, at least offensively, they fed the ball to Tyreek Hill. They fed the ball to Travis Kelce. They had some more success running the football. They only had 11 carries in this game because they were kind of playing catch up a little bit. But, you know, to me, it looks like Kansas City maybe turned the corner here despite losing this game, despite giving up 38 points. And again, that's something I think may be obscured a little bit, is that people are going to look at this game and say, you know, well, the Chiefs suck, the Chiefs this, the Chiefs that. Not give the Jets credit, but also not take a deeper look that Kansas City moved the ball with ease. The problem was they didn't have the football. They only stopped the Jets on 7 of 20 third down attempts. So, you know, hey, credit to the Jets, but I think also credit to the Chiefs here for, you know, at least showing some signs. Defensively, they didn't show too many, but offensively they did. That's what they need going forward. And I sort of feel like maybe this is a game where, yeah, they're still frustrated about the loss. Marcus Peters showing some emotion. But I think it's time to play back on the Chiefs here. We'll see if I'm wrong, because God knows I very well could be. But Joe Everett from NFL Draft Bible, what's going on over there at the Bible right now, Joe?
Oh, well, daily scouting reports, you count on that. It's every single morning coming out, and then our Inside the War Room series is fired up every week. And we've got a brand new tracker forecasting all the All-Star events, so Senior Bowl, Shrine Game, NFLPA, we're forecasting everybody that you'll see at those events. So if you're planning on those, you can check all of that out at NFL Draft Bible.
And you can follow Joe on Twitter at Joe W. Everett. Joe, thank you so much for your time, man. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you again real soon.
All right. Looking forward to it, Adam.
Great stuff there on today's show from Joe Everett. Good to get some solid NFL analysis here to open up this week on Bang the Book Radio. Just want to remind our listeners out there that with the bowl season now upon us, and of course, all the sports that are going on, college basketball, NBA, NHL, and also tapping into the futures market, something I mentioned at the top of the show that I wrote about over at bangthebook.com today, the college basketball and Major League Baseball. Critically important, always so important to be able to get the best numbers that are out there, to be able to shop around for the best lines, whether that's a game-by-game basis or in the futures market. If you don't have an account over at DSI Sportsbook, you can sign up over there using the promo code BTB and the number 25. It'll get you a $25 free bet just for signing up, 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook, and 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino if you decide to deposit over there. So again, you've got to look for those edges out there. The full game markets are very, very sharp at this point in all of the leagues. So you got to try to find those edges. Shopping around for the best price is going to be the way to do that. And you can do that with an account, DSI Sportsbook. At BetDSI, it's only a game until you bet it. One more guest left here for this Monday edition of Bang the Book Radio. That is Kyle Hunter of HunterSportsPicks.com. Kyle, how's it going today, man?
Doing well, man. Good start to the week here. Another real good week for my plays last week, so that's always a positive thing. And you know, I'm looking forward to bowl season. I have to say I'm a little bit bummed that the regular season and college football's over, but bowl season's a great time of the year too.
Bowl season is a great time of the year, and we'll talk about that here in a couple of minutes, because first I want to look at this Week 15 game, and this is one that we always talk about on the show. We want to celebrate this game, the great American rivalry between Army and Navy, this time at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia. And you know, I'm glad that this game is a standalone game. I know we talk about that every year, but I like to drive that point home. I'm so happy that this is a game that gets its place in the spotlight in Week 15, standalone game, after everybody's talked about all the college football playoff fallout and all that type of thing. This is a great game, and I certainly encourage all of our listeners to watch it.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. And, you know, I was thinking about this recently. This is a game that I'd really like to attend at some point. I think it'd be a great game to be at as a fan with all the emotion and the rivalry, but respect for each other. I'd really like to go to this game at some point. You know, Army-Navy, obviously they're not the best teams, but they're better than they used to be. Navy was beating up on Army for a long time. Now we've got a good matchup. There's always just so much emotion. I love it. You know, like you said, I think it's really good that it's a standalone game. It deserves that attention.
118th installment of this game here. Navy leads 60-50 with seven ties. Navy out for revenge this year because they lost last year for the first time since 2001. And that was easily the worst spot in the history of this rivalry because Navy was playing right after losing the American Athletic Conference championship game to Temple. It was the first conference championship game appearance for Navy. Didn't have that traditional bye week. And they seem to have a little bit of a hangover in that game. Now, that being said, this is the best Army football has been since the mid-80s. So I was a little bit surprised to see this number open 3.5. Not at all surprised to see the total come down from 51 to 47.5. But you know, as bad of a spot as that was for Navy last year, I think it obscures the fact that Army is just playing the best football that they have in basically 30 years.
Yeah, definitely. Army's just a lot better than they used to be. You know, you look back at this game here in the past, this game has been really close here for multiple years in a row. You know, this is a game where, like you said, Army had been beaten consistently, but five of the last six games in this series now have been decided by a touchdown or less. So when you look at this game, I certainly lean toward taking the points here. I know it's only 3.5, but this game could certainly come down to a three-point game. It wouldn't surprise me a bit. You know, Navy's lost five of their last six games. None of those losses have been by more than 10 points. Navy this year has three wins by 3 points or less. They also lost one-score games to Notre Dame, Temple, and Memphis. You know, Army, they've been a solid team again this year. I feel like they're on a similar level as what they were last year. Neither of these teams are very good at defending the pass, but it doesn't matter here. Neither team throws the ball. To point out how little they throw the ball, Army, in their last three games, 2.14% of their offensive plays are passing plays. That's really pretty amazing. On the season, it's 8.93%. And Navy's only at 13.47% passing plays for the year. So they're both going to be running the football, triple option. I say this every single year, but this is unique because usually you have the advantage of triple option in that the defense doesn't prep for it very often. They just have the 1 week to get ready for it. Both of these teams prep for this every single game, every single day in practice because that's what their offense runs. So usually the defense does a lot better than normal. Like you said, that's why the total got bet down right away. I think the under is 10-0 in the last 10 games between these two. You know, I don't imagine that the total will go back up here. And I will say, you know, the underdog, like I say, in a game like this, I think the underdog with 3.5 points has some value. You know, I made this line too. I'm not sure if I'm going to take it or not. But I certainly lean toward Army plus 3.5.
Yeah, my number is 1 here, and I think one of the really challenging things about this game, though, is that, you know, like you said, a lot of running plays, so you've got a very limited number of possessions, so you need to be very efficient with the drives that you get, and that's why you get a lot of unders in this rivalry, and you also get a lot of underdog covers in this rivalry. But one thing that was hard for me as I was writing up the preview for this game and is that for Navy – you know, their defensive numbers have really declined, and that's not necessarily their fault. You know, when you look at these service academy defenses, they're generally extremely disciplined. We know that they're going to be physical, but they're also undersized. And for Navy over the last 2 years, you know, they allowed 6.3 yards per play last year, 6.5 yards per play this year. So you look at that when you're handicapping this game and you say, okay, Navy is going in the wrong direction. That's a bad thing. Army, as I already talked about, playing their best football in 30 years. But Navy's playing American Athletic Conference teams now because they have a conference affiliation. They used to be independent like Army is. So Navy's just playing better offensive teams. And the AAC has a lot of good offensive teams, as we know. So I don't think that's necessarily indicative of anything for Navy, of any kind of drop-off. It's simply that they're playing higher talent. They're playing better teams. And I don't think that's something you can hold against them here against a team like Army because, as you mentioned, both of these teams run the exact same scheme. So the fact that Army runs for more yards per carry is great, but Navy's also playing better defenses than Army is for the most part. So you know, I think it's a hard handicap for a lot of different reasons. But again, it's a game that I just simply love because of, you know, what it means for both of these branches of the military, what it means in terms of the Commander-in-Chief trophy, which, by the way, Army is hoping to get that for the first time since 1996. So plenty of motivation on their side. I just love this game, and whether you have action on it or not, it's one to watch, it's one to enjoy, even if it's low scoring, even if it's a lot of running, there's not a whole lot of explosive plays. Just what this game means, the pageantry and the fanfare with it, we're all winners at that point.
Yeah, certainly, and I think you know, both of these coaching staffs have been really good. Hard to say who has a coaching edge here. You know, if I had to give one, I'd give it to Navy, just because – they've done it consistently for so many years. And like you said, they do play in a tough conference now. But, yeah, this is a game I'm looking forward to watching, even if I don't have any action on it.
All right, let's shift gears here to the bowl season. And some sports books have lines out for all these games. I think Five Dimes was hitting the market with a lot of them yesterday. A lot of markets still waiting to see what's happening. You've got lines for the later bowl games, the December 30th and the January 1st games. Also the Cotton Bowl between USC and Ohio State. I guess before we look specifically at some individual bowl games here, everyone on the show, everyone that listens to the show knows we're both Ohio State fans. Did the College Football Playoff Committee get it right?
Was there some kind of controversy or something? Did I miss out on controversy?
No, no, nothing happened yesterday.
You know, here's what I'd say as a Buckeyes fan. After the Buckeyes lost 55-24 to Iowa, I told my wife, I told my dad, you know, I'm gonna blame the Buckeyes if they don't make their way into the playoffs because, you know, you can't lose that way at Iowa and expect to get in. And that's what kept them out of it. Having said that, you know, I'm not sure that Alabama really did much to prove that they should be in either. I think Alabama is certainly one of the four best teams in the country. So if you're just looking at did they get the four best teams in the country, I think they did a pretty good job. You know, I don't have any huge beef with it. You know, I think Alabama's schedule was pretty weak. Having said that, you know, if Bama wins it now, it's certainly not going to surprise me. It's a little bit hard to say, you know, what the committee is trying to do every single year because, you know, you say, well, they're trying to get the four best team. If you're a Buckeyes fan, you know, the Buckeyes got in last year and then got beat up. They weren't really that good last year. 2 years ago, in 2015, Ohio State was very good. You remember they kind of slept, walked through that season, and then the last couple games they played really, really good. Lost that game to Michigan State at home, and then Michigan State gets in the playoff and gets absolutely drummed by Alabama. You know, that Ohio State team could have certainly won it all. Last year's team and this year's team, I don't think so. So no big gripe from me.
There are just so many elements about this thing that piss me off. And one of the questions I asked yesterday on Twitter, and I said at the time I didn't know, but I feel like I have a pretty decent idea. Now, if Ohio State beats Wisconsin 41-14, which very easily could have happened, JT Barrett overthrew some touchdown passes and then had that horrendous pick six that, you know, early on in the game tied things up. If Ohio State wins that game 41-14 instead of 27-21 like they did, are they in? And that's the problem. The fact that I can ask that question and think I have a pretty good idea of the answer really pisses me off. And I know it creates a lot of controversy. It creates a lot of discussion. And, you know, all PR is good PR and that type of thing. And this is really good for the networks, for ESPN, for the sport to have this much interest in it. But the idea that if Ohio State wins by 27 instead of by 6 changes the whole formula, that's ludicrous to me. You know, Alabama may have gotten in no matter what Ohio State did if Auburn beats Georgia and if Fresno State beats Boise State because they'd have played two conference champions. So the fact that the criteria is so vague, the fact that you know you have these decisions that are just are largely subjective more so than anything else, I think that's a problem for college football. And I don't necessarily advocate expanding the playoff. I think maybe you go to 6 and you've got the first two teams getting a bye, something like that. You know, ultimately, I think it's just it's frustrating to know that if Ohio State wins that game by 4 touchdowns, they're probably in. They didn't, so they're not in. But then the fact that they could have gotten in based on winning a game by 27 instead of by 6 with a 31-point loss to an Iowa team that Alabama probably would have kicked their ass, the whole thing is just it's a flawed system. And it creates chaos. It creates talking points. It creates hot takes. Maybe that's what they want out of the whole thing. But the fact that, you know, we had this discussion where if things go slightly different in one way or another, if Ohio State doesn't quit and loses to Iowa by 14, are they in? Like, is that the way that this thing should play out? I don't know. So I think the four best teams are there. I think when you look at the opening lines for these games, the fact that they were both virtually coin flip pick 'em situations, I think that makes sense because all four teams should be there. So, you know, I don't know, but I hope that we have more clarity on the process in future years. I just don't think that we're going to.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that, you know, the four best teams are there, and I'm fine with that. The criteria of how they get there and what they choose, how they choose those teams is the really difficult part. And I thought the other day, you know, the fact that the Boise State and Fresno State would matter for the Final Four in the playoffs really makes no sense at all. And that game shouldn't have mattered at all toward the playoffs, but it did, and it could have. And yes, I do think if Ohio State didn't lose by so much to Iowa, they would have been in. The other thing that's interesting about it to me is you think, well, some people even mentioned maybe USC should have been considered. USC was 8th in the rankings behind Auburn and Wisconsin. So they ranked Wisconsin 6th, even though they lost that game to Ohio State. Put Auburn in there 7th with 3 losses, and then USC 8th, and then Penn State 9th. And let's be honest, Penn State really didn't have any bad losses this year. That was a really close loss to Ohio State and then that weird game against Michigan State. So, yeah, the rankings are a little bit hard to figure out in the way they go about selecting them. Certainly, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how the Final Four plays out there because we got 4 good teams in the playoff this year.
And one other gripe I'll have here, UCF. So they're 12th in the final college football playoff rankings. They run the table. They beat a very, very good Memphis team twice in order to do it. They're one spot ahead of a Stanford team that lost four games and largely backed its way into the Pac-12 championship game. So I understand group of five teams don't play the same levels of schedules, at least not generally. And in order for a group of five team to make it into the final four, they're going to have to really schedule up in the non-conference. The problem is, much like the NCAA or much like college basketball, who wants to play a team like that? It is only detrimental to you to schedule Central Florida or to schedule, you know, Boise State when they were having their runs or something like that. It makes no sense for an FBS team to go out there and do that. So those teams are behind the eight ball to begin with. They're going to be behind the eight ball forever. And fine, Central Florida is not as big of a draw as the four that we have, or Ohio State or USC or Penn State or whoever else. And ultimately, the guy I talk about all the time, this generally comes down to money. If Alabama wasn't on Ohio State's level in terms of financial reach, then Ohio State would have gotten in. If it was, even if it was a team like Auburn, I think Ohio State gets in over Auburn just because Ohio State is a brand and Auburn's really not. But for these group of five teams, I mean, how demoralizing to have no shot to maybe be able to go beat Auburn, finish 13-0, and know that you still had no shot at the college football playoff. It's, I don't know what the solution is. I don't know what the fix is. And a lot of people are going to say those teams don't deserve to be there because of strength of schedule. But if you run the table, if you can go without having a slip up, you deserve something. And I don't know if playing Auburn, you know, in the bowl game that they're going to play them in, is this something that they deserve.
I agree, especially the fact to be ranked 12th. You know, you got to be at least closer than that when you go undefeated. And certainly they don't play the greatest schedule, but some of the teams that are in the playoff right now really didn't play a very good schedule either. You know, I think UCF should have at least been closer to the top four than they were. And the fact that they're so far away shows that there's basically no chance for a team like that. Like you said, why would a team like an Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State, why would they play UCF in the non-conference? They're not going to. You know, that doesn't help them at all. It can only hurt them. And that's not UCF's fault. So, you know, the system is certainly flawed, and we'll see what happens going forward. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if in the next few years we see some kind of expansion, although I would hope that they don't expand it too much. I think, you know, some people talk about 16 teams or more. I think that'd be too much, so. I mean, I think the system's better than some of them we've had in the past, but certainly still flawed.
Yeah, it really is. And what's interesting about all of this is that, you know, in the BCS era, you were encouraged to schedule up in the non-conference. I mean, you talk about a team like Baylor, for example, that very well could have been in the BCS picture a couple of times, but they played nobody in the non-conference. So as that was going on, Ohio State was formulating some of these, you know, long-term home-and-home series. They played TCU next year. It's at a neutral site, technically. It's in Arlington. So it's basically a home game for TCU, but Ohio State travels well. They play Notre Dame. They play Oregon. They play Texas. They play Washington. So they're playing some of these non-conference games, a la the Oklahoma home and home that they've had the last couple of years. You know, do we see that trend die off now? Because what the College Football Playoff Committee is effectively saying by putting Alabama in there is that strength of schedule doesn't matter as much. And you know, like I talked about a few times, Florida State having a down year didn't help Alabama's strength of schedule. There's no doubt about that. But you know, there's not as much incentive anymore to play those big non-conference games. So if those start to go away, you know, and we're not getting the Central Florida versus Georgia, Central Florida versus Auburn versus USC type games, you know, then what? Then what happens going forward? So I don't know. I think with the College Football Playoff, you know, in the short term, it's fine. In the short term, four teams works. But as we go along here, as things, you know, need to adapt, I don't know if the College Football Playoff will at the same rate.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's just an interesting situation where somebody's always going to be upset. And the criteria, it seems like it changes every year. You know, it's, well, the non-conference mattered the most. Well, now the non-conference didn't matter that much. And like you said, honestly, you know, if I was a team scheduling games now, I wouldn't schedule another top team in the early season. You know, I'd just try to get wins. And I think more of them will do that. That's kind of a shame for fans.
All right, well, let's talk about some general bowl betting things here. We've got some very good matchups out there that are going to be extremely interesting, but let's talk in general terms about bowl games. And our listeners know this that have been around with us since we started this thing in 2013, and we're going to harp on a lot of the same points, but our new listeners definitely need to pay close attention here. This is dramatically different than handicapping the regular season.
Oh, dramatically different. And in my notes here, what I put was, if you've been a listener to Bang the Book Radio in recent years, or even when we did the podcast several years ago for college football, you know that both of us think that motivation means everything this time of the year. It is easily the most important factor, not even close. Some teams are really excited to be here. Some teams are disappointed. Some teams are going to consider this a business trip. For others, it's just a reason to have vacation or have fun at the end of the season. The trick is finding out which of the teams feel that way and which teams don't. And then obviously where the game's located, which fan bases are going to travel, means a lot. Geography has to play a role in what you do in bowl season. And coaching records, coaches mean a lot this time of the year. They mean a lot every single game, but there's a lot of time for prep for a bowl game. How good is a coach at getting them ready with that extra time? I think that's really important as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That is one of the most important things is, you know, and this is kind of a corollary of motivation, but focus is so important. I mean, you go, in some cases, 4 or 5 weeks without hitting anybody but a teammate. And that's just not an ideal situation for some of these teams. If they don't have coaches that can keep them focused, how many times do we see players get arrested and suspended for these bowl games or you know, there's some other kind of fallout from something off campus? You know, every year we see it, and I'm sure we'll see it again this year. You know, do interims have the ears of the players? I wrote up my piece about interim head coaches yesterday at bangthebook.com, looking at how those guys have fared since the 2003-2004 bowl season. That's a huge deal. You know, take a situation like Florida State with Odell Haggins. Haggins is a guy that's been a coach in the program for over 20 years. The players love him. Some of the players got emotional when it was announced that he would be the interim for Jimbo Fisher. If he wasn't that type of guy, if the players weren't going to go to battle for him, why would I have any interest in playing Florida State against Southern Miss in Shreveport, Louisiana, with a Florida State team that, you know, knows what it's like to go to national championships, expects to go to national championships, but they've got a guy that maybe they rally around, a guy that's a first-time head coach here, and who knows where he'll be after the season if the new coaching staff retains him or something like that. Maybe the Seminoles do step up for that guy. If it was somebody else, maybe they don't show up at all. So those are really big factors, very important factors, and not just head coaches, but coordinators as well. You look at Mississippi State, for example, who struggled last year against Miami of Ohio in the St. Petersburg Bowl. Dan Mullen took his two top offensive assistants plus his defensive coordinator with him to Florida. How invested is Mississippi State in their bowl game? What kind of effort are they going to come out with? Those are all really, really important things. I think that's why we see Louisville open 5. Some shops are already up to 6 there. I think it's the Tax Slayer Bowl that they're in on December 30th because, you know, what kind of effort does Mississippi State come with? You'll see power ratings moves early on in the bowl season, but a lot of times you see people trying to isolate these motivation games, and that's a situation like that with Louisville and Mississippi State where you want to circle a game like that and really start diving in. NC State, Arizona State is another one. Todd Graham's been fired. Todd Graham's coaching the bowl game. Like, that is such a unique and weird element for those players. Do they listen to him? Do they care? You know, are they invested? Those are all things you have to figure out, and those are things that you clearly don't have to decide in the regular season.
Yeah, I think the interim head coaching piece, I actually brought that up right as you're talking right now. I think that's a really interesting article that people should check out because, you know, we see quite a few of those this year. It's interesting to see how they've done in the past. You know, as far as Arizona State, you know, I could get on a soapbox about them. It makes no sense. First of all, I think their coaching search and coming out with Herm Edwards and the way they described why they picked him doesn't really make any sense at all to me. But, you know, you have Todd Graham coaching a game that, you know, it'd be hard to think that the players would be paying too much attention to him, like you said, whether they listen to him or not. I know I would want no part of Arizona State in that game, but I feel like they've kind of botched up things pretty badly. I think there's a lot of different kind of situations here in bowl season. You know, power ratings still matter, but they matter less now than they do at any other part of the season to me. You know, this is the time of the year where I'll make plays even if my power ratings don't suggest that that would be a play normally. You know, if I think there's a good motivational spot, I'll certainly do something like that. And I went back and looked at this last night as far as favorites and dogs in the past 10 years and postseason play, overs and unders, things like that. It's interesting. In the last 549 bowl games, the unders 275-274. So no edge there. When it comes to favorites and dogs, it's almost exactly even. Dogs just barely covered a little bit more than favorites. The best way to go here in the past 10 years has been fading the public. You take teams that are getting 40% or less of the bets, and you're 57% in the last 10 years. I think that makes sense. You get inflated lines this time of the year, more public action than normal. So I think going against the public makes more sense than normally would.
And we'll talk a lot about these bowl games here. We're going to try to cover every bowl game on the show. We obviously won't hit all of them with Kyle, but we'll hit some of them with Brad Powers, some of them with Brian Leonard, some of them with Rolf Michaels as we go here throughout the college football season. And of course, next week we'll just have the games on Saturday to discuss, the December 16th bowl game. So we'll be able to look at some more of the games long term, look at some of these other coaching situations, line moves, and all that type of stuff. But Kyle, I want to transition over to the college basketball side of things here, because I know we got a lot of notes on that. And, you know, it's tough to try and balance college football and college basketball, especially because you're so skilled and so good at both of those sports. But following along with all this college basketball news, the injuries and the suspensions, so challenging at this time of year. You're following college football with all the, the bowl fallout. You're following the NFL because it's the biggest game in town. NBA, NHL looking for the edges there in those markets. Just so many teams in college basketball that you can overlook a lot of important stuff. There are two injuries very under the radar here that we're going to start with for this, but I'll just go ahead and call our Handicapping the Hardwood segment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these types of things are really, really important, and we always try to talk about the under the radar ones as much as we can. Ryan Taylor at Evansville, bone fracture in his foot, up to 6 weeks out. This is the go-to guy for this team by a lot. I've watched him play earlier this season. You know, everything ran through him. Now they're without their offensive leader. This is a team that tries to slow the game down even when he's playing and win low-scoring games. They're going to have a lot of low-scoring games now. I think they're going to struggle to keep up with better teams, but I wouldn't want to play any overs with Evansville, even though the lines are going to be low. He just means so much to their team. And then the second one, Preston Parks from Citadel, was kicked off the team. He had 17.5 points per game as a freshman last year. Some disagreement between him and the coach there, and they just dismissed him from the program. It'll be interesting to see what they do. The Citadel, obviously, under Baucom, a really, really fast-paced team looking to outscore you, but now they lose arguably their best scorer. So we'll see how that works going forward.
I like that you picked two teams that have very, very significant dichotomies. I mean, Citadel is the fastest team in the country. And, so someone's going to pick up that production. Just solely based on the volume that they have, it may take some time. But someone's going to pick up on that production. Evansville, on the other hand, 336th in Ken Pomeroy's adjusted tempo metrics. So do you generally find that when a team that already moves slow loses a big-time player, they just happen to go slower? So, I mean, are you looking for them maybe to actually be a decent bet as a big dog because of the lower number of possessions, or do you just stay away from that situation altogether?
I think they'll go even slower, yeah. I'd look to play unders if you can get enough value more than anything else. I'd take them as a big underdog after some time. You know, we've talked about before that, you know, when you first lose somebody and you try to adjust, you know, that's the hardest time to back a team. You know, after they have some time and get situated and figure out who's going to try to step up, then I'd be willing to take them. But for now, I couldn't take them. And I think it'll be tough for them throughout the Missouri Valley Conference slate. as long as he's not there. Now, obviously, he should be back during the Missouri Valley Conference late at some point, but until he comes back, Evansville is going to struggle. I did want to point out that favorites are 54.4% so far this year against the spread. I don't think that means much. I think regression is likely there. You know, we see things like this. It's not even been a month yet into the college basketball season. 54.4% sounds pretty good, and it is pretty good. But, you know, long term, I think that'll end up near 50-50. So will there be some value on dogs coming up soon? Probably so.
The one question I have about that is that it feels like across every sports market this year, favorites are just killing it. I mean, we know in the NFL, favorites have been outstanding for public bettors this year and have really hurt a lot of sharp guys. College football was a tough year for a lot of the wise guys out there as well. I know you had a solid college football season, but a lot of people did struggle. And favorites, I don't know if there's an over-adjustment to the notion that sharp money is going to come in on underdogs all the time. And maybe, you know, we're kind of not valuing favorites as highly as we should, or if it's just one of those weird ass years where things just, you know, tend to shift toward the chalk. I don't know, but I do agree with you that regression will come in college basketball. I just do wonder if at the end, when it's all said and done, you know, is it 50-50, 51-49, 52-48? I'll be curious to see that.
I will too. You know, just as a side note, I don't think that the favorites are going to keep covering the way they are in the NFL. And, you know, I think that's pretty obvious, but, you know, that's the type of thing that it can happen several weeks in a row, and it's not a huge shock. Now, obviously, it hurts people who are sharp players who are taking the plus 10, plus 11, and then teams just get blown out. And it's hard for the odds makers because, they're setting a line on a Patriots game of Patriots minus 17 against Miami or something like that, and then Patriots still go and cover the number. I think that regression is likely both here in college basketball and in the NFL. I think that there is some truth to what you said there about there are more people who are sharps looking to take the dog. And you know, when you have big money come in on something like that, then there's a chance that the favorites will do better than they have in the past, at least. In the past, you know, you could take underdogs and not pay any attention in the NFL and just, you know, take an underdog and you every single year you'd win. I don't think that's the case anymore, though. I don't think that, you know, favorites will continue to do that well. In college basketball, you know, early in the season, there are a lot of mismatches. You know, we get conference play starting here in some conferences now and then others coming up pretty soon. I think things start to even out here soon.
All right, well, we're kind of talking about a stock watch here, and I hope this is a concept that we bring into every show here that I do with you, Kyle. And you're kind of looking for teams that you can sell high and buy low, and we talk about that all the time on this show, looking for those buy points, those sell points, treating these teams like stocks. You do have a couple of teams here on your list, one to sell high and one to buy low.
Yeah, we'll point out that last week we talked about this with Washington State being a sell high team, and you know, Washington State goes and loses by, 17 points, something like that, to UC Davis. I certainly didn't think they were going to do that, and I wish I had played against them. But, you know, that was a spot where Washington State was never going to keep doing as well as they were, and they became overvalued. We'll see if we can find another one here. Xavier, you know, I like this Xavier team. So this is not necessarily a long-term a fade or sell high. It's just current. You know, you got to figure out, when are they going to be overvalued? They're 7-1 against the spread now. They just beat Cincinnati, really big game for them. They're shooting 54% from the floor on the year. I think there are going to be some fade spots here in the near future for Xavier. Nobody's going to shoot 54% from the floor for the season, so offensive regression is coming. And when you're 7-1 against the spread and you're a pretty big name team, you know, Xavier goes into March Madness almost every single year and wins a couple games, so I think it's a good time to sell high on that.
They're a team that I tipped prior to the season in my college basketball futures piece over at bangthebook.com, and they were going off at 80-1 at that point. I think I saw them this morning at 33-1 at Bet Online, and that's where I pulled both of those numbers. So, yeah, I mean, that team where perception and reality are kind of at an imbalance right now, and Xavier is a good basketball team, like you said, but know, they probably will run into a couple of tough spots here, you know, before they get into conference play. And also the Big East is pretty good. I mean, Seton Hall just knocked off Louisville on the road. St. John's looks better. We know Butler, even without Chris Holtman's, a pretty good team. Providence is a good team. Creighton's been a ranked team. So, yeah, Xavier's, you know, got that hot start, and they needed to do that. But, yeah, I agree with you that they are a team that probably should fall back a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, the Big East is going to be good this year. So it'll be interesting to see how they do in conference play. I think Xavier's going to be a good team. You know, like I said, it is not me thinking that Xavier's a poor team. It's just, you know, where perception is compared to where it should be. I buy low on Vanderbilt right now. They're 0-7 against the spread on the year. An overtime loss at home to USC, close loss to Kansas State yesterday. You know, they haven't been very far off, but when you're 0-7 against the spread, the odds makers have to lower their numbers on you. And people who have been betting them are going to be jumping off, because who wants to lose consistently, you know, time after time with them? I think Drew is a quality coach. I think Vanderbilt has some nice pieces there, especially in the backcourt. So I think Vanderbilt, while I'm not saying that they're going to be a great team this year, I think that it's good to buy low on them at 0-7 against the spread.
I think the timing couldn't be better with them, because Middle Tennessee State is a team that we talked about last week as one of those mid-majors that people just kind of take for granted that they're going to be really good. But the Blue Raiders lost a lot from last year, and I don't know if perception is going to catch up with them right away. Here against a Vanderbilt that hasn't covered a number yet, getting Middle Tennessee at home, a little bit, something of a rivalry game. Murfreesboro is about an hour and a half or so from Nashville. That may be a really good buy spot for Vanderbilt.
Yeah, that's a really interesting game. And I will say, I remember this game last year. Vanderbilt lost badly to Middle Tennessee State. I just looked at 71-48 on the road. So Vanderbilt's going to be really pumped for that game. I think Middle Tennessee will be ready for that game as well. But Vanderbilt probably laying a really short number there. I would take Vanderbilt or nothing there in that one. You know, I think that Vanderbilt's one of those teams that just, you know, maybe they're only 500 or something like that overall, but ATS, they have to be better than 0-7. You know, the numbers are going to get too low on them at some point here.
All right, we're trying to do some conference breakdown stuff. We talked about the SEC. I think it was last week. It may have been the week before. But this week we're going to talk about the Big Ten, and I'll let you go ahead and run down through your bullet points here, because you've got several teams listed, and it's kind of amazing. The Big Ten has already started conference play, and I'll be curious to see if that's something that's a benefit for them, you know, getting some of these conference games out of the way early, you know, maybe scheduling a little bit like the SEC does in college football, where you play some of your conference games, then maybe you play a Mercer-type team, something like that. But the Big Ten has already started conference play, so with that in mind, you know, what are you looking at from this conference?
Yeah, that's why I decided to talk about the Big Ten this week, because they started conference play. That surprised me. I don't know why they changed it. You know, but the Big Ten, the bottom of the Big Ten is a lot better than it used to be. There are not many off days here. Rutgers is probably still the worst team in the Big Ten, but you know, they have a good coach, and I think that's a program going in the right direction. Ohio State doesn't have that much talent, but Ohio State's playing really hard for Chris Holtman. You know, I don't think there's any easy game here in the Big Ten this year. So it's going to be an interesting conference. A clear favorite here is Michigan State. I'm really impressed with their defensive tenacity so far this year. Number two in defensive efficiency, according to Ken Pomeroy. Last year, 37th. They have really, really good freshmen and sophomores. I think Nick Ward's pretty underrated. Jaren Jackson's shot blocking ability changes this team. And obviously Miles Bridges being as good as he is and coming back for a second year is really key for them. But I think Michigan State's a clear favorite here. I go a notch down than Purdue. Purdue's more balanced on offense this year, not quite as reliant as they were on the interior in the past. You know, they have more depth in the backcourt. I think Purdue is a team that is better suited to make a run in March this year than they have been in the past. So I think in Michigan State, you've got the clear favorite, Purdue a clear second. And then you jump down a little bit to some more teams there in the Big Ten that I think are solid teams, but not on the level of those top two. And there I'd say Minnesota. You know, Minnesota has been coached well. Keno's done a good job there for them. The question is, can they take that next step? And if they do, it needs to be on offense. Their offense wasn't efficient enough last year. They've been really good so far this year. on offense, but I'm a little bit skeptical based on who they play. You know, let's see what they do against good teams on offense. I think they'll be good on defense. They'll force a lot of turnovers. Teams will take tough shots against them, but can they score well enough consistently? We'll see about that. Northwestern, you know, they were the darlings of March last year. That made them overvalued here early this season, and we talked about that a few weeks ago. But this is still a good team. This is a Northwestern team that I think will have a good season. Collins does a really good job with this team, coaching them up. I think Northwestern is going to be solid again this season. Michigan, I think Beilein's an underrated coach. They're always really well coached, very efficient on offense. Michigan doesn't have the most talent in the Big Ten, but I think they'll still be a tough team to beat. And, you know, a question mark to me, what about Wisconsin? What do we make of their early season struggles? 0-5 against top 65 teams in the country, really relying on Ethan Happ. And Ethan Happ's really good. But, you know, you can't have one guy trying to do that much, especially when he's in the front court. You got to have some good backcourt play, and they're not getting that right now. So I think Wisconsin certainly is going to be better than what they've shown so far. I think that Wisconsin's a couple notches down from where they've been in the past couple seasons. And then a sleeper for me, Penn State. You know, Penn State's a team that I think most people have, you know, picked maybe 10th or 11th in the Big Ten so far, or before the season is where they would predict them. But I could see them making some noise and being a bubble team for the NCAA tournament. Why do I like them? I like them because they've had a lot of consistency in who's back. You know, they have a lot of juniors and seniors. They're 23rd in minutes continuity in the country. So they've got a lot of players back that have played a lot in the past couple seasons. They have a lot of depth. I think Penn State's going to be quite a bit better than they've been in recent seasons.
I like a lot of what you said there, and I like that you went through team by team looking at some of the contenders, some of the teams that could be a little bit better than expected. And, you know, it's fascinating to me that you have, you know, for a little while you had that Nebraska resurgence under Tim Miles. Obviously, Indiana's a team you expect to be really good, but they're down, you know, quite a bit at this point. And then, you know, obviously the start to the season that they had, not particularly good when you get blown out by Indiana State. Apparently getting blown out by Seton Hall isn't as bad as it looked, you know, at the time, because Seton Hall's played really well. But it is a fascinating conference to look at because, as you said, you know, you don't have those bottom feeders. You don't have those teams you can beat up on. And that can sometimes be a problem for the conference heading into the NCAA tournament. If you don't have teams that have 24, 25, 26 wins, you may see one or two of those in the Big Ten here. But, you know, it seems like conference wins are going to be spread out quite a bit here and, you know, may lead to some underseeded Big Ten teams as we go forward, which, you know, may have some future implications.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that Big Ten's a good conference here in basketball. Not an easy team to beat here anywhere. And another team I didn't mention is Illinois. You know, Underwood's going to do a good job with them. I don't think Illinois has the talent they need to be really good in the Big Ten so far. But, you know, they play a unique style. They're going to use that trapping defense and force a lot of turnovers. They're going to speed up the game. I think that Illinois is a team that I'd look to back later in the season as they kind of will probably have a hard time early on against the better teams in conference. But as Underwood coaches them up, I think they'll get better. And I think in general, the Big Ten, there's a lot of good coaches. And when you get this many good coaches in one conference, should make for some interesting basketball.
All right, let's head out to Richmond here, and let's talk about a couple of games. We're actually going to be in the state of Virginia here for this one. Let's talk Texas and VCU here. We're actually going to be in the state of Virginia for both games, I should say. You know, you've got Shaka Smart taking on his old team, you know, so that's obviously a pretty intriguing situational spot there. What is it that you're looking at outside of that in this game?
Yeah, this one, I don't necessarily have a strong lean as far as what I'm going to play. It's more just interesting game. You know, Shaka Smart's Texas team has been really good on defense, but they're struggling efficiency-wise on offense. It'll be interesting to see how they can do here. Texas has more athletes and has a deeper team than both VCU. VCU is going to be sky high for this game. They're going to be really up for this game. So I'm interested to see what happens here. I'm also interested to see what kind of number gets posted here. I think that'll tell us a lot about what the odds makers think of of Texas and VCU, because, you know, this is a big game for both teams. You know, Texas has to be favored here. You know, I think if it's more than by a couple points, the Sharps are going to want to take VCU with the points. So we'll see what this number comes out at. To me, this is going to be a fast-paced game. Both teams want to play really quickly. You know, VCU has a new coach this year in Mike Rhodes. Rhodes did a really good job at Rice. I think that, you know, Rice is way down from where it was when he was there. I think VCU is going to be very solid. VCU has been well coached for multiple years in a row now. But I think this is an interesting game because you get a good coaching matchup. You get Chaka Smart going against his old team. Very fast-paced game. We'll see who comes out on top.
Is VCU still doing what they were doing under Chaka Smart to the same effect, or have they changed it up a little bit post the Chaka Smart era?
VCU is still playing really fast. Less of the pressing, not as much forcing turnovers as they did in the past. VCU takes a lot of three-pointers now, so they're reliant on the outside shot. They're making 41.1% so far this year on threes. If they keep that up, they're going to be tough to beat. I don't imagine they'll finish shooting 41% from three-point range. You know, you look at Texas, that's where Texas has struggled here, is they can't shoot it from outside. Last year they were 29% from long range. So far this year, 27.2%. So Texas, the key is, can they hit any shots from outside? And, you know, for VCU, Texas is going to have to defend out beyond the arc because that's where they like to shoot.
All right, so we'll stay in Richmond here, and let's talk about them coming up all the way out on Saturday. And you know, this is something for our listeners to keep in the back of their minds, of course. You know, we try to look ahead. You know, we don't have overnights when we're recording or anything like that, so we try to look ahead, look to isolate some of these spots that, you know, may end up being really advantageous. And you got a fairly under the radar game between James Madison and Richmond. You know, a team that has made a lot of noise in the A-10 before, but this year, not the same team that we're used to seeing.
Yeah, Richmond's pretty bad this season. They have a good coach, so they'll get coached up. You look at Richmond's first couple games this year. I mean, that was really, really bad. That horrible loss to Jacksonville State, blowout. I don't remember exactly how many it was, but it was a big loss. And James Madison coming into this game, you know, this is a rare chance for a James Madison team to knock off an interstate rival. You know, only a couple hours away from Richmond. They have to be up for this game. You know, Richmond plays ODU the game before this. To me, Richmond cares more about that Old Dominion game than they do about this James Madison game. So certainly my lean here is James Madison plus the points. I'm a little bit worried about how many points we're going to catch, because Richmond has played so poorly. If Richmond gets blown out by Old Dominion, I might pass on this one because it might be too small of a number. But, you know, say James Madison's catching 7 points or something like that, I'll take James Madison here. I think James Madison is a good enough team. Stucky Mosley leading them there, used to be at Toledo and was a very good player there for them. I think they have enough scoring to keep up with Richmond. You know, this should be a close game. And usually when you see James Madison against Richmond, you don't think it's so. I'm curious to see what this line comes out at, because the perception usually would be this will be a blowout. The thing that hurts this one is that Richmond has lost some really ugly games early in the season, so certainly possible we've lost quite a bit of value. I still think James Madison is the side I'd prefer, but like I say, it depends on how many points we're catching.
Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com. What's going on over there at the website right now, man?
Well, certainly a busy time of year. I've been really hot of late. I always say, you know, I'm honest whether I'm cold or hot, and the last couple weeks have been great. 18-3 in my last 21 basketball plays. I'm going to extend the $499 totals package for college basketball and NBA for one more week. So if you're interested in that, let me know. Also, a bowl season coming up, 16-5 in my last 21 college football totals. It's been a really good college football season in general. My bowl totals package is $199 through this coming Sunday. So that's totals only throughout the bowl season. Bowl all access, $279. So if you're interested in either of those, email me, Kyle at huntersportsfix.com, or message me at Kyle Hunter Pitts on Twitter.
Well, man, always a treat. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Good stuff there on today's show from Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. Coming up on our Tuesday edition of Bang the Book Radio, we'll hear from Alex Nicholas of Minor Rush, the SB Nation home of the UTEP Miners. We'll talk about what's going on with UTEP and Tim Floyd's abrupt retirement. We'll also get some thoughts from him on Conference USA teams here in the bowl season, and then also on some Conference USA college basketball. Do a little bit of specialization with that. We'll also pick up another guest for tomorrow's show. On our Wednesday show, Brian Leonard and Wes Reynolds join us. Thursday, Brad Powers and Rolf Michaels. Friday, Westgate Super Contest selection segment. And I've already told Joe Everett, if I get the Bengals tonight and go 4-1, he's got to do this week's segment because he might be my good luck charm. But we'll see who does ultimately fill in for that. And then also Brent from DSI Sportsbook with this week's version of the odds report. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.